Ever since I was fired in 1993 from the Worldwide Church of God, I have slowly but surely been learning a principle that neither I nor anyone else could have ever really fully understood prior to that time. I'd like to explain in this sermon what it is and why this principle may be one of the most important principles that I have ever heard in my life, that I have ever come to understand in my life. And I want to be sure that everybody who is in RCG, they're absent here or absent elsewhere, hears this sermon. Brethren, out in the world, big is valued. To the human mind, bigness is important. Bigness has value. It's the way it is in the world, and it's the way it is to the human mind. If somebody has a big house, they have more value. The more square footage they have, perhaps the bigger yard they have, the more acreage they have, the more value seems to be attached to them. Big companies are better than little companies. Little buildings don't grab people's attention. It's the big buildings of a skyline that seems to define a city, not the people who are there, but how big the skyline is. New York is called the Big Apple, often called the Big Grapple for those who are there, because it's got all these huge buildings. But as many people have said, it's an apple filled with worms when you understand that the big buildings don't define the city. Big cars are better than little cars. People who go to big schools seem to be able to speak more confidently and boldly and brag more about their school experience than somebody who went to a little school. If people have a big net worth, that seems to have value. The top 400 richest people in America are listed every year as though we all care about that. You know, I've never been in that 400. I don't think I'm ever going to be in that 400. I've never known anybody in that 400. It has absolutely no value to me, but apparently it has value to people who watch that sort of thing, or people wouldn't be counting them, checking out their net worth, and listing it every year to see who goes up, who goes down, who slipped a notch, who went up three notches, and so forth. I personally don't care what Bill Gates is worth. He may not even know because it changes so often. People are out there trying to make the big score. If you follow online investing, here's an article in the recent paper, San Francisco Examiner, online investors wager at a dizzying pace. The shooting spree carried out by a distraught Georgia investor has focused attention on the stressful world of people who play a white-knuckle, high-stakes game of buying and selling stocks on personal computers. With day trading, there's no quicker way to stare into the abyss of your soul, said the San Francisco day trader and author. A day trader's life is always about the deal they missed or a stock they got stuck with. You can put an incredible amount of your money at risk day trading. And when things go south, you can suffer incredible losses and just lose it emotionally. Now, why would people be doing that? The answer? They want the big score. They want the big bucks, and they want it now. They want it fast. Traditional professional stockbrokers in the past buffered people from those daily stock market mood swings that now hit people and swing people's moods. You know, if you have a big child is of more value. Talking about how big a baby is more exciting than a small one. My mother weighed 2 pounds, 3 ounces. That's not a story. But our oldest child weighed 10 pounds, 2.5 ounces. Lacking a half an ounce, being 8 pounds bigger than his grandmother. Now, which one sounds more, wow, you had a big baby like that? Well, I have an aunt. My wife has an aunt who's 4 feet 11. She weighed 14 pounds when she was born. I often tell people she had half her body weight at birth. You know, sweet little thing. But she hadn't grown much since the womb. And so, but big has value. People notice big rings. I remember Michael Irvin of the Dallas Cowboys doing a commercial about how he drove a big car. And it points to, I live in a big house, and our Cowboys won the Super Bowl, and now I got a big ring on my finger. I don't even remember what the commercial was about, but I remember how big was beautiful. Bigger stadiums and arenas are better than little ones. Bigger cities have more value than little ones. If you're a professional athlete, boy, your goal is to pull down a big contract, not a little one. People's job is to be able to say, hey, I got a big job. I got a big assignment. I've got big friends in high places. Nobody wants to be a small fry. Everybody wants to be a big shot. You look at life, and that's the way people are. Now, I'll just be honest with you. There are some people who will actually value me more because I'm tall. It has taken one-third of a century for me to figure out, and I hope I can help you today by looking at scriptures that are all through the Bible, but you just have to put them all together to see the incredible pattern that is there. But it took me a third of a century to realize that I valued big. Now, there are some natural reasons for that. Because human beings think big where God thinks small, and human beings think small where God thinks big, and I'm going to prove that to you. I valued big. You know, it's interesting. In the Worldwide Church of God, I started two congregations. Now, I pastored a lot, but I only started two, and they were both big. I had a lot of big pastorates. I had some of the biggest pastorates in the church. At one time, I pastored 1,100 people. Another pastor, I think the smallest one I ever had was 400, 450. Now, in Global and in Restored, I have started 75 congregations, and they were all small, and very small in many cases. Too small for some people, though, they don't count as a church. Now, the fact that Christ said, wherever two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in their midst, seems to get lost. It's only a congregation, or it's only a church. If it's big and there's numbers there. But you know, after you start 75 groups and you meet with and work with little teensy-weensy groups of people, brethren, I'm here to tell you, it changes you. It changes the way you think. I don't think the way I used to. You will find that where God is big-minded, people are small-minded. But where God thinks very small and values what is small, people value big. And it's wrong. And it all starts from Isaiah chapter 55. Isaiah chapter 55. Now, I will unabashedly tell you, brethren, I hope this sermon changes you. It is my intention to change, with God's help, the thinking of all of us toward Christianity from this moment forward, both those in this room and those outside this room who will hear this message in time to come. Because I want every single person who is with us or who comes with us to hear this sermon. Isaiah chapter 55 and verse 7. Now it says, let the wicked forsake his way, the unrighteous man his thoughts, and let him return to the Lord, and he will have mercy upon him and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. For my thoughts are not your thoughts. God says, in effect, let's just summarize it, I don't think the way people do. Neither are your ways my ways, says the Lord. How far apart is God's thinking and his values and his ways from people? Well, verse 9 tells you. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways and my thoughts than your thoughts. It's not like, it's even close. God views things tremendously differently from people. He just does. Conversion, we were taught, is coming to think and to do as God thinks and does. Now, I have never known Isaiah. I don't know him. I hope to meet him in the kingdom of God. But I have come to where I can understand why God inspired him to write this after a couple chapters earlier he said this, chapter 53 and verse 1. Because this is the way ministers feel. You can stand up here and preach and pour your heart out and know that there are people sitting out there who don't believe a bit of it. They don't do a thing. They don't understand a word you say. They walk out of Sabbath services and don't put a single thing into practice. But they came to church with a tie on or a dress on, and they live none of it. And Isaiah said, Lord, who has believed our report? And to whom is the arm of the Lord revealed? Remember Mr. Armstrong quoting that verse at times when he was frustrated with the fact that people didn't understand the particular sermon he was giving. Who has believed our report? Which is more remarkable, brethren, that 150,000 people came into the church? Or that at any given point in time, 250 million were hearing Mr. Armstrong, and only 150,000 came into the church, and of that 150,000, the vast majority of them didn't get a thing. They did not understand. Who has believed our report, which is God's report, as Isaiah would put it, meant to put it really in the sense of what he was saying, that's the meaning. Who believes God's leaders? When Mr. Armstrong said, I don't think half of you get it, when he said that, I didn't get it. I didn't get what he meant when he said, I don't think half of you get it. And I surely didn't get it when he said, I don't think 90% of you get it. And I don't think most people got it any more than I did until we found out false leaders could come and could simply sweep everybody away. I found myself saying in 1993 over and over again, I was shocked. I couldn't believe what I saw and what I've seen ever since. I kept asking myself, and you will remember my exact words, how could so many give up so much, so fast, because of the deception of so few? And I could add, after knowing God's truth so long, how could they do it? I said it over and over again. I still marvel at it. Let me just say again before we start looking at some fascinating verses regarding the size of things in life. Where God thinks big, people think small, and where God thinks small, people think big, and I'm going to prove it to you. Turn to Zechariah chapter 4. I'm going to go so far as to say anybody who does not understand the core of this sermon will eventually stop walking with us. They just will. I will predict there will be people sitting in this room right now today, and I normally am not this bold, who are going to walk away. Some of you maybe soon, maybe later. I'm getting to where I can tell before people are going to leave. I can watch their attitudes. I can watch them start picking. I can watch them start accusing. Normally, they stop living the Bible and ironically find a way to accuse others, find fault with others. They'll pick at people like chickens in a barnyard. It's an amazing thing. But Zechariah chapter 4 says in verse 6, then he answered and spoke to me, not by power, by might, and so forth, but by my spirit. Verse 9, the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this house. His hands shall also finish it. And you shall know that the Lord of hosts has sent me unto you. For who has despised the day of small things? Well, I'll tell you who despises the day of small things. Almost everybody does. I remember reading in the autobiography, which has given me a lot of encouragement in recent months, how Mr. Armstrong drove on when a lot of people just stood back and said of the college, we'll just wait and watch this thing fold up. There may be some of you sitting here think we're going to fold up. We're not. There may be some people who fold their tent, but we're not going to fold up. Most people despise the day of small things. Fortunately, thankfully, Mr. Armstrong understood that he couldn't think about numbers. When Mr. Armstrong did, in effect, exactly what you have done and what I have done, he left the era that he was a part of with a tiny group of people, 19, counting his wife and kids, and held fast. And about 18 years later, he was up to 150 people. Now that's major growth, isn't it? If you say, well, he grew eight times over, yeah, I guess it would be major growth, but I'm being somewhat sarcastic, I guess would be the word, facetious, better word. Obviously, that's very slow growth. It was after a long, long time that it began to take off. He would start little congregations, and he would hand them to people that he trusted, and before he was barely out of town, the elder that he trusted and ordained would destroy it. The elder that he thought was just so solid, looked so good, just tore it to pieces. Of all the elders that Mr. Armstrong ordained in Oregon, one stood fast. His name was Basil Wolverton, and he died in the faith. You're all familiar with, and some of you enjoyed his humor. All the rest, Mr. Armstrong as a human being looked at and said, well, he seems right, he seems faithful, was wrong. Now, is 150,000 people a lot? Not when you compare it to 6 billion people on Earth. That's small. That's small. So slowly over recent years, God has been hitting me over the head, and I'm sure others as well, with a fundamental biblical reality that is profound. Let's start with who God chose in the Old Testament. God chose Israel. And he tells us that she was the least of the nations, and as a matter of fact, was not even a sovereign nation. It was a number of millions of people who were caught up as slaves in Egypt. Now, if you're God, and you're about to place your name on a group of people, I can't think of a more ignominious, teeny-weeny start than to cast around and pick a small nation, not a Liechtenstein, you know, not a Netherlands, not a little teeny country. The one was in slavery. It wasn't even a sovereign nation. It'd be like picking the Chechens, who are an ethnic group within Russia, or some other ethnic group, like the Kurds. The Kurds are a people, but they're not a nation. They're scattered in about 3 different nations. And God says, I'm going to pick the Kurds. I'm going to pick the Chechens. And he picked the least of the nations. And he picked people that were from the race that were the least of the 3 races. It's kind of interesting. I've often thought, if white people think they are more special to God, well, they're going to have trouble proving it to me based on numbers. And if black people think that they're the most special, they're going to have trouble proving it by numbers, because God has more yellow people, and then he has more black people, and then white people. So God picked, even among the races, the least race, picked a tiny country, and then basically picked one that was in slavery. And he says, now that's where I'm going to work. And you're going to find it's an absolute typical approach to the pattern of God. Now I'm going to refer to some stories, and we're actually going to study and read some stories. But there's so many, it's amazing. Let's go back to the book of Genesis. Who was God working with prior to the flood? Every evidence is that over a period of 16.5 centuries, God worked with a grand total of 8 people. And they're called the preachers of righteousness. And after 7 of them came along, Abel, Seth, Enos, Canaan, Mahalalel, Jared, and then Enoch, the line of successors was broken by Methuselah and Lamech until Enoch's great-grandson Noah stood up, picked up the baton, and went on. So for 16.5 centuries, essentially God worked with 8 people, and the first one got killed pretty fast. And the 7th one didn't live all that long compared to the others. He lived 365 years. That's a long time to us, and not very long compared to the others, because they were persecuting him. He stood absolutely alone. I have never been absolutely alone, and neither of you as a servant of God. You know, those guys would have had a major problem if their definition of success and conversion and the right place to be was bigness. And they represent over 1/4 of the period of time that people have been on earth. Well, then how many survived through the flood? To the post-world flood? 8. And no, brethren, of those 8, only probably 2 were converted. Noah and Shem. The lifestyles of the others would indicate they were not converted. They just were not converted. They didn't get the point. But God wanted to preserve the races, so he brought eight people through the flood. How many lived in the pre-flood world? Nobody can know. How fast do people multiply? Well, people lived a long time, had a tremendous number of children, and each of those children had a tremendous number of children. I've long believed that there were a lot more people prior to the flood than most people might guess, but I can't prove that. In any event, there were eight out of whatever that number was that came through the flood. Genesis 18, remarkable story. Of course, it's the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. Well known. I think all of us understand the story. And you have this remarkable dialogue between Abraham and God. Now, I guess when you're the friend of God, you can have this kind of a dialogue. In a way, I envy people like Abraham who could literally sit down and discuss face-to-face with God as Melchizedek whatever he wanted to talk about. We kneel down in a place and try to see the invisible. God is invisible. But Abraham could actually discuss things with God. And verse 16, and the men rose up from thence and looked toward Sodom, and Abraham went with them to bring them on the way. And the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham that thing which I do? No, he was his friend. Friends tell their friends what they have in mind. Seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him, started with one man, Abraham, for I know him, that he will command his children, his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he has spoken of him. The Lord said, because the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sins very grievous, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the cry of it which has come unto me, and if not, I will know. And the men turned their faces from thence and went toward Sodom, but Abraham stood yet before the Lord. And drew near, and he said, now are you going to destroy the righteous with the wicked? And then begins this wonderful exchange that is written for our learning, as Paul said, upon whom the ends of the world have come. Suppose there's 50 righteous within the city. Are you going to destroy everybody because of the 50? And of course, you know God's answer was no. Well, verse 28, well, what if there's 45? Is that enough? Yes, that's enough. God said, I will spare this whole city of rotten homosexuals, absolutely perverted people, if just a small number like 45 are there. Verse 29, 40 enough? Yep, that's enough too. Verse 30 asks about 30. Yes, that's enough. Verse 31, is 20 enough? Of course, Abraham's got Lot in mind, his nephew. And in verse 32, oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak yet but this once, peradventure 10 be found there. God said he would literally set aside what he would do to all these people if 10 people held fast. And they were right. I will not destroy it for 10's sake. And the Lord went his way as soon as he had left communing with Abraham. And Abraham returned to his place. Well, of course, there weren't 10. There was just Lot, daughters. And of course, the city was destroyed. The city was destroyed. Judges chapter 6. Judges chapter 6. A remarkable story. And I'm not going to take a lot of time to read it because most of you know it, but let's just briefly review it. It's the story of Gideon's army. Now let me just tell the story. But first, in order to appreciate the army, which we know essentially cut down to 300, you have to say to yourself, well, surely if God's going to take an army of 300 people, he is absolutely going to pick a tremendous general. He's going to pick a Patton. He'll pick a Rommel. He'll pick a Pershing. He'll pick a MacArthur. He'll pick a great leader because he's got to win with 300. No, that's not the way God thinks. Verse 15, Gideon had been balking. He didn't want to go lead this army. Not because he was a wimp. He just couldn't believe he could be God's choice. And he said to him, oh my Lord, verse 15, chapter 6. Oh, my Lord, wherewith shall I save Israel? Behold, my family is poor in Manasseh, and I'm the least in my father's house. And what Gideon didn't understand is that made him a perfect candidate, because God's not into big armies or big men. of great leaders. God said, I'll be with you, and you're going to smite the Midianites as one man. So in case you think 300 is very few, as far as God's concerned, it was like using one man. And 32,000 got cut down to 300, less than a percent, less than 1%, led by a person who was, in fact, the least in his house. The Apostle Paul, and I don't think he recorded this because he somehow just was self-effacing, said, I am the least of the apostles. He didn't say, I'm a great man. And when people are in my presence, they're in the presence of a great man. Mr. Armstrong never thought that way. Just hearing the sermon a couple weeks ago when he was talking about makeup and he was describing how it's no big deal to see him humanly, just hit me again. I'd heard it before. Several times before, but I'd just forgotten Mr. Armstrong, that aspect of Mr. Armstrong really bothered Mr. Armstrong, that people would sort of semi-worship, really, really troubled him, distressed him. Let's look at David, 1 Samuel. So many stories in David's life. Let's go to when David was picked, and let's even ask the question about why David was picked. The answer is in 1 Samuel 15:17, real simply. God rejected Saul because, as Samuel said, when you were little in your own sight, were you not made the head of the tribes of Israel, and the Lord anointed you king over Israel? This big man was little in his own eyes. And God says, because he thinks little of himself, I can use him. But that changed. So now God said, well, I'm not only going to pick somebody who thinks little, I'm going to pick a man who is little. And that's what chapter 16 is about. And the Lord said to Samuel, how long will you mourn for Saul, seeing I've rejected him from reigning over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go, and I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided me a king among his sons. And Samuel said, how can I go? If Saul hear it, he will kill me. There's this great servant of God who, like many others, can be weak, can vacillate, and even be fearful. Samuel, great servant of God, was weak. Well, I said, take a heifer and say, I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. And call Jesse to the sacrifice, and I'll show you what you shall do. You shall anoint unto me him whom I name unto you. And Samuel did that which the Lord spoke and came to Bethlehem. The elders of the town trembled at his coming to come you peaceably. It's not every day you get a visit from Samuel. He said, peaceably, I'm come to sacrifice to the Lord. Set yourselves apart. Come with me to the sacrifice. And he sanctified Jesse and his sons and called them to the sacrifice. It came to pass, when they were come, that he looked on Eliab and said, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. And the Lord said unto Samuel, look not on his countenance or on the height of his stature, because I refused him. Now maybe Eliab was another tall person. Maybe the pattern was, well, if Saul was tall, we'll pick another tall guy. For the Lord sees not as man sees. For man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. So God's servant, Samuel, got fooled. All of God's servants, I'll just tell you right now, get regularly fooled by people. I'm going to show you that in a way that will surprise you later on. And here's an example. Then Jesse called Abinadab, made him pass before Samuel. He said, neither has the Lord chosen this. He didn't say chosen him, just sort of said this. How would you like to be called this or it? Then Jesse made Shammah to pass by, and he said, the Lord's not chosen this. And he made seven of his sons. And finally, this little boy, little freckle-faced, ruddy-faced shepherd boy that wasn't even prepared, was fetched. And in verse 12, arise and anoint him, for this is he. Nobody, humanly speaking, could figure out, partly because of the pattern that existed of Saul, nobody could figure out that it could possibly be David. Why, from the very beginning, when Israel entered the land, the first order of business, brethren, was God had to wipe out a bunch of giants who stood in their way because they all thought they were grasshoppers. Well, they're big. They're going to beat us because they're big people. No, they're not. The Zamzamims, the Emims, the Rephaim, the Anakims, and so forth, the other Ims that were there, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward. And then what did David do? first thing he did is went out and killed probably the biggest human being who's ever lived on the face of the earth. And did it with some stones. It was no problem to God at all. Absolutely no fear in him because he understood size means nothing to God. Numbers mean nothing to God. Now later on, David himself forgot this. Because what did he do? He went out and numbered the armies. He forgot that size means nothing. And he found out he had an army of 1.3 million people. He must have thought, wow, this is impressive. I've got 1.3 million people. But this was the same David who understood that size doesn't mean anything. Even when he was a youngster, or certainly a young man, the smallest, the run of the litter, and David had in fact killed this giant with one blow. Now, let's look at chapter 22. And there's a parallel with many of us. Chapter 22 and verse 1. David therefore departed thence and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brethren and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him. And everyone, now notice this, that was in distress, and everyone that was in debt, and everyone that was discontented gathered themselves unto him, and he became a captain over them, and there were with him about 400 men. Now I wanted to read these verses and give this sermon when I was sure that we were somewhere between 400 and 600, because before I comment on that, flip the page over to chapter 23 and verse 13. A little while later, not too much, you'll notice verse 13, 23, then David and his men, which were about 600, arose and departed out of Keilah, and went whithersoever they could go, and it was told Saul that David was escaped from Keilah, and he forbore to go forth. Well, there was a period when all David had, this man who will one day be over the 12 apostles and all the tribes of Israel, struggled along, actually, brethren, for a number of years, between 400 and 600 men. And were these the beautiful people? Were these the talented people? Were these the people that were fun to be around socially? Nope. They were the ones in distress, in debt, discontented, and throw in a few family members. And that was David, 400 men. Now, he had some wives and children, so what would the total have been? I don't know. Maybe 1,000, maybe 2,000, out of millions. How many millions were in Israel? I don't know. I know millions we have felt, 2 to 3 million, 2 to 6 million we've thought perhaps came out of Egypt over four centuries earlier, well over four centuries. But exactly how many, I don't know, would have been alive at this time. Many of those who are coming with us will not be the beautiful people. Probably most of them. And when you stop and consider that God doesn't call beautiful people, he calls the weak, the foolish, the base, the things that are not, and the things that are despised in the first place, and then out of those, out of people who start out in that category, you have the least of those people, because the beautiful people usually don't figure out what Christianity is. They don't understand that it has nothing whatsoever to do with numbers. And we all have to go through a phase in our life where we understand big means nothing. It means nothing. I valued big, brethren. I did. I valued big. The only thing that's important about big is if you have a big experience, learn from it. You know, the distressed meant those who were disabled, anguished, distressed, whose lives confined them. This is what the Hebrew means. And they had a difficult life. You look up the Hebrew word, and that's what the word distressed means. Those who were in debt were under imposition. People were imposing debt on them. They couldn't pay their bills. They struggled. Their lives were difficult. But they recognized that David was different. The discontented were the bitter, the chafed, the angry. They'd been dealt a bad hand. And yet they were mighty men of valor. They were willing to go take on odds that were very, very difficult. These weren't the rotten apples. These were those who were chafed. Nothing wrong with being angry. The Bible says, be not angry with your brother without a cause. And don't let the sun go down on your wrath. And the Bible warns about being soon angry. But if we're angry, it ought to be a certain righteous indignation. We don't want a root of bitterness in us, but there's nothing wrong with being wounded and recognizing you've been wounded and feeling chafed by it. So certainly David understood he was going to be king, but it didn't happen for a long time. And someday all the 12 apostles are going to report to him. And the whole reason David, this little runty brother, was picked, nobody, including God's great servant Samuel, could have understood, not his own father Jesse, was because a tall guy stopped being little in his own eyes, Saul. He got big in his own eyes. Look at Ecclesiastes 9. Solomon recorded some remarkable wisdom. Solomon was very different than David, his father. But Ecclesiastes 9, this wisdom have I seen also under the sun, and it seemed great to me. Now I wonder, is the wisdom we're about to read about, brethren, that will it seem great to you? Because this is a great wisdom, and this is coming from the man who had more wisdom than any man who has ever lived on earth. And among all that wisdom, he said, this is a great one. There was a little city. Well, this doesn't sound very impressive right out of the gate. And few men within it. And there came a great king against it and besieged it and built great bulwarks against it. And I'm going to add a thought that's not in there. Everybody was betting on the great king and the besiegement and the great bulwarks. Nobody, I'm going to tell you right now, I wasn't there, but I'm going to tell you, nobody was betting on the little city with few men. I guess this has greater meaning to me, having toured the Alamo last Friday. You know, sang about it as a little kid. Davy Crockett had been there. Remarkable story of how 200 men, led by a leader, wrote a letter trying to get help in the battle for independence in Texas, faced 6,000 people under Santa Anna who'd marched up from Mexico City to put down these Texans. Jim Bowie and William Bonham and James David Crockett, which is really what his name was, were holed up there, 200 against 6,000, outnumbered 30-1, and they wrote under their leader, I think it was Captain Travis was his name, if I've got the right person, and he basically just said, it'll be victory or death. And he drew a line in the sand. He said, everybody's going to stay and fight to the death, because let's not have any question about this. This is a fight to the death, outnumbered 30-1, we're not going to win. One guy didn't cross the line. There were 201 men there. One guy didn't cross the line. He leapt over the wall at night and disappeared and got away. You know, it's interesting. History records that he ran. We know his name. The other 200 died. And after they died, even those who were wounded would request, please do not shoot me in the head. Shoot me in the chest. They would immediately shoot them in the head, stripped them, threw them in a pile, and burnt them. I went right to the spot. Fascinating. To the spot where Davy Crockett was fighting. They know exactly where he died. And he said, I can't fight in here. Want to die? We went outside. He said, I want to fight in the open. I can't fight hemmed up. He died. Now, at the end of that battle, Santa Anna said, this is a small affair. They asked him for his comments. It was a small affair. Little did he realize history would record, songs would be sung. The Alamo, that was already 115 years old by the time of the battle, and that was March 6th, 1836. Now, a long time ago, and here we are still talking about it in a sermon. You learned about it in school. A few days later, by now far more than 6,000 soldiers had joined Santa Anna, and they met in a place called San Jacinto. I believe it was Sam Houston who led the battle, if I've got it correct. With 54 casualties taken, 6,000 Spanish were killed. Mexicans were killed by only 54 casualties. So God doesn't need a lot of people. So here you got this little city with a few men, and a great king besieging it. Now there was found in it a poor wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city. Yet no man remembered that same poor man. Then said I, wisdom is better than strength. People wouldn't say that. People say, I want strength. I'm going into a battle. I want a big army. That's what David thought, and as a result of that mistake, 70,000 people died in a plague because he just thought, I just got to know how big my army is. How many divisions? How many battalions? How many regiments? How many soldiers? Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. Now, it wasn't despised at the time he brought out a plan and said, here's how we can win, because they employed it, and it worked. But nobody remembers little people. Nobody cares about what they say afterwards. It gets forgotten. Now, if he was a great man, if he was the salt in the Brunei, and he stood up and he said, here's how to win, we'd all remember him, and we'd probably be singing songs about him. One reason the Alamo is so famous is because Davy Crockett was there. He was not a poor little guy. He'd been in Congress. He'd been elected to Congress 6 times. He was well known, 50 years old, famous. From Tennessee and so forth. I don't know if he killed in the bar when he was only 3, but I sure sang about it. But there's a difference between David and Solomon. David started very small, and the kingdom grew great under him. Parallel almost with Mr. Armstrong in some ways, started very small, and the church grew tremendously large. But David's successor, Solomon, took this huge nation, and he frittered it away. You know, we talk about Solomon's temple because he's the one that put it together. David assembled everything. Solomon gets credit. In a way, it's David's temple. But nobody calls it David's temple because he wasn't allowed to build it. Solomon was, but he gathered everything. And under Solomon, the kingdom began to split. Actually, after Solomon, because of seeds that Solomon sowed, after Mr. Armstrong, the successor took a great church and just destroyed it. Basically, just destroyed it. Turn to 1 Chronicles 29. It's a remarkable prayer. 1 Chronicles chapter 29. And verse 10. Wherefore David blessed the Lord, coming to praise God openly, addressing them as this offering is being gathered for the purpose of building. Blessed be you, Lord God of Israel, our Father, forever and ever. You, O Lord, to you is the greatness, the power, the glory, victory, and majesty, for all that is in the heaven and earth is yours. Yours is the kingdom, and you're exalted as head above all. Both riches and honor come of you, and you reign over all, and so forth. Verse 14, but who am I? Now David had grown large in terms of his authority over the kingdom, but unlike Saul, he never thought big of himself. Who am I and what is my people that we should be able to offer so willingly after this sort? Just read all of what they brought. Just read it. First half of the chapter. For all things come of you, and of your own have we given you. You own everything, and here we're going to give this back to you like we owned it. For we are strangers before you and sojourners as were our fathers. Our days on the earth are as a shadow. And there is, and the Hebrew means, there's no expectation when you look at us, but God used this ruddy little kid to do remarkable things. Now he sinned, but God can save through many or few, whether it's David alone killing Goliath, 300 who represented God in the battle against Midian under Gideon. Doesn't make any difference. God can save by many or by few. Elijah thought he was absolutely alone and wanted to die. God said, no, I had 7,000. Oh, wow, 7,000. Wait a minute, 7,000, that's nothing. Out of millions? Now, it's a lot if you think you're totally alone. But out of millions, 7,000? Come on. That's small. Ezekiel chapter 5, what is the message about how many are going to be protected in the place of safety? Brethren, we had better get this. If you've been slow to learn this lesson, then you're no different than me. I can tell you that. I'm going to tell you why the church was not prepared to learn this lesson. Ezekiel 5:1, and you, son of man, take you a sharp knife and a barber's razor and cause it to pass upon your head and upon your beard. Then take you balances to weigh and divide the hair. Throw a third part, and you burn it with fire in the midst of the city when the days of the siege are fulfilled, and you shall take a third part, smite it with a knife, And a third part, you shall scatter in the wind, and I will draw out a sword after them. You shall also take thereof a few in number, and bind them in your skirts. We've always understood that that's a very few people taken to a place of safety. Now, few is a funny thing, a funny term. It's like if somebody is fat, who decides how fat is fat? Somebody's short. Well, how short is short? It's a relative term. How big is big? How tall is tall? You say, well, there were many. Well, that can mean many things to many people. The word many. If it's a few, how few is few? I don't know. However few it is, the next verse says it's going to be even fewer because it says, then take of them again and cast them into the midst of the fire and burn them in the fire. For thereof shall a fire go forth unto all of the house of Israel. Some are actually cast out of the skirt. Some will cause problems in the place of safety. I got a recent letter asking about this. We've always said that. So even those who get there, there's going to be a problem. Now we know there are going to be tares in the place of safety. You know that because the tares are there to the harvest. Only a few get to the place of safety. They're bound up. Some of those aren't converted, so the number's even fewer. And after they get there, a few of them are going to get thrown out. But you know, brethren, to get people to understand that, or even for me to understand that God thinks few, little, don't despise the day of small things, is hard. Most people don't want to remember stories about little. They want to remember stories about big. That's why the poor man's wisdom in this little city with few men is forgotten. Nobody remembers him because people value strength over wisdom. When God gathers Israel, Jeremiah 3 and verse 14 says it will be two of a family, one of a city, and he will bring them back to Israel all over the world. Just one and two and one and two and one and two. Now let's jump to the New Testament. Turn to Matthew chapter 7. What's the New Testament pattern? We've looked at the old. What's the New Testament pattern? Well, first of all, brethren, you know that God started with 12 guys. 12 apostles who were sent into all the world. That's all he had to start with. But look in Matthew chapter 7, verse 13. After it talks about what we call the golden rule, then it says, enter you in at the straight gate. Now, this is what I'm telling you. I am telling you, Christ said to the disciples, enter in by the difficult gate. For wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and many, there again, numbers, there be which go in thereat. Because straight is the gate. It's difficult. That's what it means, straight. And narrow is the way which leads to life, and few there be that are finding it. I've learned, brethren, if God can basically put 150,000 into what we now know as a corporation, most were not in the church, out of 250 million who heard the truth, out of a whole world of 6 billion. And then we see of the 150,000, the vast majority walked away, and we shouldn't be surprised. Mr. Armstrong told us over and over that most of them didn't get it because he understood these verses, even if we didn't, that it could be so few it's almost unbelievable when you look at all of the stories. But I said, I am telling you, go into this difficult gate and only a few are going to make it. Now keep looking at these verses as they appear. Matthew 22. Matthew 22. Those who do not make it to the wedding, they don't have on a garment. Verse 14, for many are called, but few are chosen. The whole story is about people who made excuses. Sorry, can't make it. Can't make it. I pray, brethren, you will remember these principles every time you think that the American way is God's way. The American way is there's safety in numbers. The American way is you define what's right by the majority. What did the big number think? Whatever the large number thinks, that's what's right, and that's who we elect as a president, or elect as a senator, a governor, a congressman. It's the larger number. God doesn't think that way. He never has. Many are called. Now, this is of the number that are called, few are chosen. I'm convinced a lot of those who are called come right into the church, but they never are chosen because they never yield to God. Luke 10. Luke 10. Let's look at a bunch of verses in Luke. Luke 10 and verse 2. Therefore said he unto them, the harvest truly is great, but the laborers are few. There's nowhere you'll find in the scriptures that God is working with many. He's working with few. Pray you therefore, the Lord of the harvest, that he would send forth laborers into his harvest. You pray that God will increase the few, but that's the number of laborers that God uses. And we're told to pray about it. You're given the ongoing instruction by God to accept the fact, to understand the fact that God only has a few laborers. Because of that, they have to work hard. Their reward is great, but they have to work hard, so pray that God will give a few more. Luke 12. Here it is again. Fear not, verse 32, fear not, little flock. I mean, do you ever stop and wonder, where did we get the idea we have to be part of something big? I'm going to show you. For it's your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. And I know a little flock would fit this, so there's just not enough of us. And his sheep get picked off because they don't understand there's a roaring lion out there. They don't pray. They don't study. Some of you brethren probably fasted the last time, last atonement. Monday, you'll look back and say the last time you fasted was probably last atonement. Even though Jesus Christ, my servants shall fast often. Chances are that was the last time some of you fasted. Maybe a lot of you. Fear not, little flock, chapter 13. Chapter 13. And verse 18. Then said he, under what is the kingdom of God like? And whereunto shall I resemble it? Oh, the kingdom of God, this great, tremendous thing that's going to come to the earth. Yes, it will be in time. Is that the way it's going to start? It is like a grain of mustard seed. Have you ever seen a mustard seed? Little teensy-weensy, I believe they're black. It's one of the smallest seeds you'll ever see. I've got hickory nuts falling all through my yard. Tons and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. It's hard to mow the lawn. Well, a grain of mustard seed. My daughter works at the mustard seed up here. I know the owner, and he's building 5 of the largest natural food stores in the world. When you put them all together, it'll probably be the biggest single privately owned chain in the world. It's going to be right here. And yet he picked the name mustard seed. Now maybe it's because he started small and it's going to grow great. Maybe he understood that. I don't know. A grain of a mustard seed, which a man took, cast into the garden, and it grew and waxed a great tree. God is starting with a teensy, weensy number of people. Mr. Armstrong said, we are the kingdom of God in embryo. I'm going to ask you, how big is an embryo? An embryo is tiny, hard to even weigh it. It's so small. Microscopic, and it'll grow into a great tree, but God starts with something that is as tiny as a mustard seed, basically the size of a large pencil point. That's the way God starts. Chapter 15 and verse 4. I know what my calling is. I have no doubt what my calling is, and I'm going to do it for the rest of my life, and these verses summarize it. There'll be people who understand this and people who don't, and I won't be able to control that. But I've come to understand after many years, maybe I should have understood it a long time ago, I don't know, God will have to judge me. But chapter 15 and verse 4 spoke this parable. What man of you, having 100 sheep, if he lose one of them, does not leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after that which is lost until he find it? And when he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders rejoicing. I think our job is going to be, brethren, let me just be very plain, to help one and one and one. Yes, we've had some chunks of people come with us. God has to start with a certain number, and there's some have come with us who weren't any more with us than a hole in the head. The Restored Church of God was just the latest event, the latest happening, the latest exciting place to be, and emotional energy drove them on. And that's probably true with some of us here. And as soon as the emotion, which is all that those people's religion were, dies down, they're gone. They're gone as quick as emotion is gone. Because they weren't living the book. And so we've lost a few, but we continue to get more than we lose. I saw that in Global and other groups the same way. You get a few people because God says he will raise up rocks. And I'm convinced Christ said it because he does it. He raises up rocks. When he has enough people, he doesn't need the rocks anymore. The rocks leave. That's exactly what happens. I've seen it. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and neighbors, saying unto them, rejoice with me, for I found my sheep, one of them which was lost. And I say unto you that likewise joy shall be in heaven over one sinner that repents. God doesn't say, I need thousands to make my day exciting. There's great joy, joy in heaven when one person, just one, over the 99 persons who have no need of repentance. Just one. Chapter 16 and verse 10. You begin to see it's almost every chapter here. Chapter 16 and verse 10. He that is faithful in that which is least, in little things, is faithful also in much. And he that is unjust in the least is unjust also in much. So God tests, brethren, whether you can handle little things, whether you will despise the day of little things, whether you can appreciate that you don't have to be part of a big army. There doesn't have to be a lot of people in Sodom and Gomorrah for God to say, I'll stop it. It only takes 10 and I won't destroy it. So when God destroyed it, believe me, the eyes of God had combed that city and they were all rotten. And when it says all flesh had corrupted his way prior to the flood, that's very specific. And the earth was filled with violence and so forth. God means what he says. John 6, remarkable story. John 6, we're going to look at verse 66. But prior to that verse, you will find that Christ made some basic statements. You have to live my way. Now listen, brethren, look at what he said. You know this story. We read it every Passover. Verse 53, except you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. Whoso eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. Verse 56, he that eats my flesh and drinks my blood dwells in me and I in him. And he that eats me, into verse 57, even he shall live by me. Verse 58, he that eats of this bread at the end shall live forever, and so forth. Verse 63, it is the spirit that quickens, the flesh profits nothing. The words that I speak unto you, they are spirit and they are life. Verse 65, and he said, therefore said I unto you that no man can come unto me except it were given unto him by my Father. You know what happened after he said, you have to live this way. You have to take me inside you and live this way. And from that time, many of his disciples went back and walked no more with him. You know, when we found out in the wake of an apostasy where God tested tens of thousands of us, we found out many people were not living the book. And as soon as false leaders came in, many of what we thought were the disciples in the church walked away and walked no more with him. And then said Jesus unto the 12, will you also go away? And they said, well, where are we going to go? You have the words of eternal life. Only 12, just 12 old people there. And one of you has a demon. In verse 70, there's really only 11. Very, very few. 2 Timothy chapter 4. 2 Timothy chapter 4. And verse 10. The Apostle Paul made a reference to a person called Demas. For Demas has forsaken me. Now, Paul apparently made a lapse in judgment. He picked Demas. Having loved this present world, here Demas was working right beside this great servant of God, Paul. And Paul, like Samuel picking Jesse's sons incorrectly, Paul had used Demas. Matter of fact, two of Paul's servants became the second and fourth popes, and they're listed in the Encyclopedia Britannica by the Roman Church as the second and fourth popes in the succession after they count Peter as their first pope. We know that's not correct. But having loved this present world, it is departed unto Thessalonica, and Crescens to Galatia, and Titus unto Dalmatia. The implication is they all just walked down on me, and only Luke stayed with me. Take Mark and bring him with you. Bring Mark to me. Paul had been abandoned by some people he needed that he counted on, and only Luke, this physician, stuck with him. I watched Mr. Armstrong and talked with him at times. I'm not ashamed to say this. I'm not embarrassed. I don't care if people believe it or not. It frustrated him. He was lonely late in his life. He watched one person after another after decades absolutely betray him. The people we thought were the giants in the work didn't believe anything. He talked with me many times about people very close in his family. Need to allude to them, you can guess who they are, who had betrayed him. How shocked he was to find out that they betrayed him. The leaders around him betrayed him. His successor betrayed him. His family members betrayed him. Second wife betrayed him. Mr. Armstrong had to learn what Paul learned. But Paul says there's only Luke left. Mr. Armstrong picked all these men, he trained them, thought they were faithful, and they all turned and betrayed him and destroyed everything that he built. But you know what, brethren, we all got in the habit of thinking bigness. Because under Mr. Armstrong, this extraordinary and unique and prophesied individual who would come and fulfill a remarkable role, we all saw that the church was literally on a roll. Tens of thousands of people were baptized, 20 every day, 7,200 a year, year in, year out. We basically saw about 7,200 people come in every year. We saw about 600 leave. It just seemed to be a pattern year after year after year. I would caution Akron. I would caution all of us. Yes, we may grow overall. I'm not so sure Akron will grow. I think Akron might drop for a while. Then we might get some others coming from other places. But there are some who came here because it was the bigger group, but who aren't living the book. Numbers mean nothing to God. There's a parallel in the first century. First day of Pentecost, 3,000 baptized. And I could take you through 26 separate places in the book of Acts. 26 places where lots of people were baptized, and lots of people, city after city after city. And yet by the 90s AD, 60-some years later, the church was broken, scattered. Only John was left, and John wasn't even allowed to fellowship with the church. It was ripped to pieces. Thousands roaring in, an exciting time at the beginning of the church. Then you got 18 centuries where basically there's a curtain that comes down until God raised up Herbert Armstrong, and most of us were called into the church. Big churches, lots of churches, activities, socials, parties, youth programs, public Bible lectures, 357 television stations, booklets, literature. Big was in because a unique prophecy was being fulfilled. And when that prophecy was over and people had to live the book, many went back and never walked again what they were never walking before. Numbers have nothing to do with fruit, and you're hearing it from somebody who's pastored almost 9,000 people. I've started two big churches and about 75 or 80 little churches, and I'll tell you, little is God's way. God even says in Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 2, when you're going to say something, even let your words be few. Few is important to God. God says in Luke 12 that when a sparrow falls out of the nest, or the lilies need water to grow, he notices that. He counts the hairs on people's heads. You and I wouldn't do that. That's the way God thinks. He looks at little events. They have meaning to him. There's no safety in numbers. Numbers mean nothing. You know, I want to say this, and I want you to remember this. And periodically, I hope you'll go back and listen to this sermon, maybe read these scriptures again, because most of you in Akron do not understand something. Most of the places where God's people have been meeting, there's two rows. There might be one row. And a lot of you out there who are hearing the sermon beyond the shores of this room are sitting in a living room where it's a husband and a wife and two kids, and you're dressed up, you've got a tie on, you opened with prayer, the Father will do that, the Father will close. There might be 10, might be 15, 20, 30. We've got a few groups meeting in halls, but it's small. And some are absolutely alone. I wish we had more feast sites, but we don't. Look at Luke 21. Luke 21. Wish we had more ministers, but we don't. Wish we had more churches where people could attend, but we don't. Brethren, we're spoiled here, and I don't care if people outside Akron hear that I said that about you. You're spoiled. You're a wonderful, loving group. But everybody who has been here for years knows I almost never correct you, and I probably should do it more. You're a wonderful, loving group. It upsets me when people say you're not. We've had some people leave us recently who thought you aren't. You are. I always marvel that the people who have the least love seem to be the quickest to know when others don't have it. But brethren, we're a little spoiled. We have a large group here. We have dances. We have picnics. We have activities. We have a wonderful hall. And it's just not happening for a lot of other people in a lot of other places. And you need to pray for them and remember them. Luke chapter 21. We've talked about every other aspect of big and small, seemingly. How about this? And he looked up, verse 1, and saw rich men casting their gifts into the treasury. And he saw also a certain poor widow casting in there two mites, just a few pennies, just a teensy, weensy amount of money. And he said, of a truth, I say unto you, that this poor widow has cast in more than they all. All these rich men giving huge amounts, they don't even know it's gone. It's like Bill Gates when they ask him, and I told you this story, Bill, what was it like to lose $7 billion in 2 hours in the crash? $7 billion in 2 hours. He said, I didn't feel a thing. Didn't feel a thing. Didn't know it was gone. Because he went from $38 billion all the way down to $31 billion. Now, how in the world is he going to pay for his next meal? He wouldn't even miss it. But if you've got two mites, God says, I see those little teeny things. And that means more to me than all of the rich men and all of the bigger amounts they give, but it doesn't hurt them. They don't sacrifice. They don't go above and beyond. They don't care about anything but themselves. Why? Because Ecclesiastes 5 says this. Now in verse 2, it says, let your words be few. We were talking about that at the end of the verse. Verse 10, he that loves silver shall not be satisfied with silver. See, again, back to the people want the big numbers, the big wealth, the big bank account. They want to be known as the big hitter, the heavy hitter. Now, he that loves abundance with increase, this is also vanity. But people think it's what you're supposed to do. So people go out and they seek increase and they seek abundance because that's the American way. Well, happiness is something you pursue. We're given the right by the Constitution to pursue happiness. Not many people are finding it, by the way, but a lot are pursuing it. But what you really want is, as one man said, the way you really determine who wins in life is who can die with the most toys. Boats, planes, cars, you know, TVs, whatever else. But the problem is when goods increase, they are increased that eat them. And what good is there to the owners thereof, saving the beholding of them with their eyes? What difference does it make? If you've got a certain number in the bank account, what difference does it make how many zeros just keep on following it? It just doesn't make any difference. It's not satisfying, but that's why people do it. They go out and they seek it because it's the way. And he that loves those things is going to be hollowed out by it. Yeah, we'll have fewer people. We'll do a smaller work. People will slip in and slip out because we won't have enough ministers. People will travel further to services. But small is God's way, and I don't care. I just don't care. There are two scriptures in Revelation 3 that describe the difference between the last two eras. And may we never, brethren, never forget it. It's a lesson I am determined to never forget. So far, I'm surprised that so many have come with us. But it still isn't many. A few hundred. You say, well, Mr. Pack, I know you don't want to know the numbers, but couldn't you just give us an idea? I really don't even want to know. I don't want to know. I know God is providing for us in terms of income. It'll never be enough. But it's always enough in one sense. Never be enough in another, in that you'd like to do more. But I'm determined we are going to do everything in our power to reach out and try to find that one and bring them to the 99 with God's help. Well, verse 7 talks about the instruction, the message to Philadelphia. Verse 8 comes down to, I know your works, I've set before you an open door. No man can shut it, for you have but a little strength. You kept my word, you've not denied my name. You're persecuted by this group called the Synagogue of Satan. You hold fast what you have. Your personality is, verse 12 says, it's pillar-like. You're willing to go out if necessary. I'm going to make you a pillar so you don't have to do that. But you've got little strength. When you look up little, do you know what you're going to find it means? It means little. Not big. Not big. Now there's another group that is called rich and increased with goods. For a long time, they said, well, they're spiritually rich. Yeah, they have that problem too, but that's not what it's talking about. You look it up. When it says rich, it means money. When it means increased with goods, it means goods. That's exactly what it's talking about. I remember hearing in about 1990 or 91 a perversion by the current pastor general of the Worldwide Church of God, who was saying, well, holding fast, he said that in effect to hold on to old ideas was what being rich and increased with goods meant. I heard him say it at a conference in Philadelphia, and I think it was 91. That's what it meant. Well, we've got the truth. We don't need to learn and grow. And he was subtly undermining those who would hold fast. And you have a smug Laodicean attitude because they still thought there were church eras in 90 and 91. And the way to know a Laodicean is he wanted to hold fast, and he was planting the seeds. And I sat there and thought, wow. It hit me like a ton of bricks. You know what rich and increased with goods means? It means rich and increased with goods. You know what little strength means? It means little strength, brethren. That's what it means. Just take the Bible at face value. Remember, it's been purified over and over again. Now, let me tell you something. We will struggle at times. God will always pay our bills. You'll always come in here and the light bill will be paid. You watch. Just watch. There'll be people who are watching, and they're among us, and others outside, and they're prophesying our destruction. They just know, like Ambassador College in 47, how could four students, with seven faculty members teaching four students, how can they survive? And the next year, it was all the way up to seven students and seven faculty members. Now it was one-to-one. But one man with tremendous vision, Herbert Armstrong, kept on keeping on. He absolutely knew and understood nothing was going to stop him, while others stood, said, when this thing folds up. Well, then a lot of people decided later on to hitch their wagon to his star when it seemed like he had something special going. The gravy train was rolling, and in came the people. Of course, God was fulfilling a remarkable prophecy, and we grew 35 years at 30% per year. Sometimes I actually believe it was on the strength and vision of one man. I said earlier, brethren, that people basically think big where God thinks small and think small where God thinks big. We've talked an awful lot about where people think big where God thinks small, but what do I mean by the opposite? Most people take the small view of life. The big view, because God is the one with the biggest view of all, is that he sees things that are small, and big doesn't impress him, whether it's numbers, whether it's the size of an army, the size of the church, or the size of the person that David was commissioned to destroy, or the tribes waiting in the land of Canaan that had to be removed before Israel could occupy it. Yeah, I could take you to 2 Peter 2, when false leaders rise up, then it says, many are deceived, not few. I could take you to all the verses where it talks about many will follow his pernicious ways. Whenever false leaders come in, that's when you find the minis. When it talks about people who hold fast the way God is working, it's small, it's little, it's few. And I will never again, till the day I die, despise the day of small things. And I know I did, and I know some of you did. Why? Because we came in and it was natural. First of all, it's the way people think, but secondarily, we came in when things were just big, and the next year they were bigger, and the next year there were more feast sites, and more and more and more. It was fantastic, and we got used to it. It's just nobody was living the book. Nobody was living the book. God always sees the big picture, the long 6,000-year view. Most people take the short view. If we didn't grow to be a certain number, some people have already left us because we didn't get big enough fast enough. I can't believe we got as big as we did, but to some people, it's just bigness. It has nothing to do with blessed are the meek. It has nothing to do with practicing love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance, or holding fast doctrinally, or the fact that we won't bend on it. That has nothing to do with it. It's just numbers. They look around and say, well, there's none of the people here at the feast. This isn't a big enough room. And that'll be the way they think, and they'll be gone. And ultimately, they will not continue to build their house. I'd like to read a remarkable story that was sent to me by an elder in another group. He's called the Carpenter. An elderly carpenter was ready to retire. He told his employer contractor of his plans to leave the house building business and live a more leisurely life with his wife enjoying his extended family. He would miss the paycheck, but he needed to retire. They could get by. The contractor was sorry to see his good worker go and asked if he could build just one more house as a personal favor. The carpenter said yes, but in time it was easy to see that his heart was not in his work. He resorted to shoddy workmanship and used inferior materials. It was an unfortunate way to end his career. When the carpenter finished his work and the builder came to inspect the house, the contractor handed the front door key to the carpenter. And he said, "This is your house. It is my gift to you." But he didn't know that, so he built a lousy house. What a shock, what a shame. If he had only known he was building his own house, he would have done it all so differently. Now he had to live in the home he'd built none too well. So it is with us. We build our lives in a distracted way, reacting rather than acting, willing to put up less than the best. At important points, we did not give the job our best effort. Then with a shock, we look at the situation we've created and find that we are now living in a house we have built, in the house we have built. If we had realized that, we would have done it so differently. Think of yourself as the carpenter. Think about your house. Each day, you may hammer just one nail or place one board or erect one part of a wall in just a little part of the house. Build wisely. It's the only house you will ever build. Even if you live it for only one day more, that day deserves to be lived with grace and dignity. The plaque on the wall says, "Life is a do-it-yourself project." He concludes by saying, "Who could say it more clearly? Your life today is a result of your attitudes and choices in the past. Your life tomorrow will be the result of your attitudes and the choices you make today." And then it concludes, "Pass this on to someone you like. I did. I don't know this man, but I'm awfully glad he sent it to me." Now let me tell you, I'm going to send out this book to everyone. It'll be a beautifully bound book. You've heard about it, and it's called "Except the Lord Build the House." Because Psalm 127 and verse 1, we sing it all the time, says that God is building a house. And except he build it, you know, the weary builders toil in vain. You know the words. Except God keeps the city, the watchmen watch and wake, but in vain. Small and careful and a little bit at a time is the way God builds his house. Brethren, do not despise the day of small things. It's God's way. It may not be people's way. In this world, big is valued. In God's, small, but quality is valued. To the human mind, bigness is important. But to God's mind, smallness is important if it is his standard quality.